I've passed out a long 67-page manuscript, and I'll read the first half of it this morning and then stop and read the second half this afternoon. The first section is called, Is the Topic of Truth Relevant to Democratic Politics? The question of whether there are any beliefs or desires common to all human beings is of little interest apart from the vision of a utopian, inclusivist human community, one which prides itself on the different sorts of people it welcomes rather than on the firmness with which it keeps out strangers. Most human communities are exclusivist. Their sense of identity and the self-images of their members depend on pride in not being certain other sorts of people, people who worship the wrong god, eat the wrong foods, or have some other perverse, repellent beliefs or desires. Philosophers would not bother trying to show that certain beliefs and desires are found in every society, or are implicit in some ineliminable human practice, unless they hope to show that the existence of these beliefs demonstrates the possibility of, or the obligation to construct, a planet-wide inclusivist community. In this paper, I'll use the term democratic politics as a synonym for the attempt to bring such a community into existence. One of the desires said to be universal by philosophers interested in democratic politics is the desire for truth. In the past, such philosophers have typically conjoined the claim that there is universal human agreement on the supreme desirability of truth with the further premises that truth is correspondence to reality and that reality has an intrinsic nature, that there is, in Nelson Goodman's terms, a way the world is. Given these three premises, they proceed to argue that truth is one, and that the universal human interest in truth provides motive for creating an inclusivist community. For such a community would be best suited to accomplishing our desire of discovering the one truth. The more of that truth we uncover, the more common ground we shall share, and the more tolerant and inclusivist we shall therefore become. The rise of relatively democratic, relatively tolerant societies in the last few hundred years is said to be due to the increased rationality of modern times, where rationality denotes the exercise of a truth-oriented faculty. The three premises I've listed are sometimes said to be necessitated by reason. That is, the premises that everybody wants truth, that truth is correspondence and to reality, and that reality has an intrinsic nature. These three premises are sometimes said to be necessitated by reason, but this claim is usually tautologous, for philosophers who say that typically explain their use of the word reason by listing those same three premises as constitutive of the very idea of rationality. They view colleagues who have doubts about one or another of these three premises as irrationalist. I have a footnote about Nietzsche, James, and Habermas as people who are called irrationalists for rejecting one or another or more of those premises. Degrees of irrationality are attributed according to how many of these premises the distrusted philosopher denies, and also according to how little interest he or she shows in democratic politics. In this paper, I'll consider the prospects for defending democratic politics while denying all of the three premises I've listed. I'll be arguing that what philosophers have described as the universal desire for truth is better described as the universal desire for justification. The grounding premise of my argument is that you can't aim at something, can't work to get it, unless you could recognize it once you got it. One difference between truth and justification is just that, between the unrecognizable and the recognizable. We shall never know for sure whether a given belief is true, but we can be sure that nobody, at the moment, is able to summon up any residual objections to it, that everybody agrees that it ought to be held. There are, to be sure, what Lacanians call impossible, indefinable, sublime objects of desire, but a desire for such an object cannot be made relevant to democratic politics. On my view, truth is just that sort of object. It's too sublime, so to speak, to be either recognized or aimed at. Justification is merely beautiful as opposed to sublime, but it is recognizable and therefore capable of being systematically worked for. Sometimes, with luck, justification is even achieved. But that achievement is usually only temporary, since sooner or later, with luck, some new objections to the temporarily justified belief will be developed. As I see it, the yearning for unconditionality, the yearning which leads philosophers to insist that we need to avoid contextualism and relativism, is indeed satisfied by the notion of truth. But this yearning is unhealthy because the price of unconditionality is irrelevance to practice. So I think the topic of truth can't be made relevant to democratic politics, and that philosophers devoted to such politics should forget about truth and stick to the topic of justification. Now I turn to Habermas. In order to place my view within the context of contemporary philosophical controversies, I'll begin with some comments on Habermas. Habermas draws his well-known distinction between subject-centered reason and communicative reason in connection with his attempt to separate out what's useful to democratic politics in the traditional philosophical notion of rationality from what's useless. I think that he makes a tactical error when he tries to preserve the notion of unconditionality. Although I think Habermas is absolutely right that we need to socialize and linguistify the notion of reason by viewing it as communicative, I think that we also need to naturalize reason by dropping his claim that, quote, a rationality is built into factual processes of mutual understanding, close quotes. Just as a remark here, tomorrow morning I'll be discussing Brandom's philosophy of language, which is exactly the kind of philosophy of language Habermas wants. That is, it socializes and linguistifies the notion of rationality. And the question that I'll be discussing in connection with Brandom is there a moment of unconditionality built into Brandom's way of thinking of inquiry, in what sense, and so on. Habermas, like Putnam, believes that reason cannot be naturalized. Both philosophers think, and that's a phrase from Putnam, endorsed by Habermas. Both philosophers think it important to insist on this point in order to avoid the relativism which seems to them to put democratic politics on a par with totalitarian politics. You could say, if there's a moment of unconditionality, then you can't naturalize it. Both think it important to say that that democratic politics is more rational than totalitarian fascist politics. I don't think we should say that, because I don't think the notion of rationality can be stretched that far. We should admit that we have no neutral ground to stand on when we defend democratic politics against its opponents. If we don't admit this, I think we can rightly be accused of attempting to smuggle our own social practices into the definition of something universal and ineluctable, because presupposed by the practices of any and every language user. It would be franker, and therefore better, to say that democratic politics can no more appeal to such presuppositions than can anti-democratic politics, but is none the worse for that. Habermas agrees with the criticism which post-Nietzschean writers have made of what Derrida calls logocentrism, and specifically with their denial that, quote, the linguistic function of representing states of affairs is the sole human monopoly, close quote. So do I, but I would extend this criticism as follows. Only over-attention to fact-stating would make one think that there was an aim of inquiry called truth in addition to the aim of justification. More generally, only over-attention to fact-stating would make one think that a claim to universal validity is important for democratic politics. Still more generally, abandoning the logocentric idea that knowledge, is the distinctive human capacity, would leave room for the idea that democratic citizenship is better suited for the role of the distinctively human capacity. The latter is what we human beings should take most pride in and should make central to our self-image. As I see it, Habermas's attempt to redefine the term reason after deciding that, as he says, the paradigm of the philosophy of consciousness is exhausted, his attempt to redescribe reason as communicative through and through is insufficiently radical. It's a halfway house between thinking in terms of validity claims and thinking in terms of justificatory practices. It comes down halfway between the Greek idea that human beings are special because they can know, whereas other animals can merely cope, and Dewey's idea that we are special because we can take charge of our evolution, take ourselves in directions which have neither precedent nor justification in either biology or history. The latter idea can be made to sound unattractive by dubbing it Nietzschean and construing it as one more form of the same will to power which was incarnate in the Nazis. I'd like to make it sound attractive by calling it American and construing it as the idea common to Emerson and Whitman, the idea of a new self-creating community, united not by knowledge of the same truths, but by sharing the same generous, inclusivist, democratic hopes. The idea of communal self-creation, of realizing a dream which has no justification in unconditional claims to universal validity, sounds suspicious to Habermas and Oppel because they naturally associate it with Hitler. It sounds somewhat better to Americans because they naturally associate it with Jefferson, Whitman, and Dewey. The moral to be drawn, I think, is that this suggestion is neutral between Hitler and Jefferson. If one wants neutral principles and on the basis of which to decide between Hitler and Jefferson, one will have to find a way of replacing Jefferson's occasional references to natural law and self-evident political truths by a more up-to-date version of Enlightenment rationalism. This is the role in which Habermas and Oppel cast what they call discourse ethics. Only if one has given up hope for discourse ethics and for all other attempts at such neutrality will the alternative I'm suggesting seem attractive. Whether one gives up that hope should, I think, be decided, at least in part, on the basis of one's view of the sort of argument from performative self-contradiction which is at the heart of discourse ethics. I see that argument as weak and unconvincing, but I have nothing better to put in its place. Because I have nothing better, I'm inclined to reject the very idea of neutral principles and ask myself what philosophers might do for democratic politics apart from trying to ground this politics on principles. My answer is, they can get to work substituting hope for knowledge, substituting the idea that the ability to be citizens of the full-fledged democracy which is yet to come, rather than the ability to grasp truth, is what's important about being human. This is not a matter of what Oppel calls Letztbegründung, but of redescribing humanity and history in terms which make democracy seem desirable. If doing that is said to be, as Oppel calls it, mere rhetoric rather than proper argument, I should rejoin that it is no more or less rhetorical or argumentative than my opponent's attempt to make discourse, to describe discourse and communication in terms that make democracy seem linked to the intrinsic nature of humanity. New section on truth and justification. There are many uses for the word true, but the only one which could not be eliminated from our linguistic practice with relative ease is the cautionary use. This is the use we make of the word when we contrast justification and truth and say that a belief may be justified, but still not true. Outside of philosophy, this cautionary use is used to contrast less informed with better informed audiences and more generally past audiences with future audiences. In non-philosophical contexts, the point of contrasting truth and justification is simply to remind oneself that there may be objections, arising from newly discovered data or more ingenious explanatory hypotheses, or a shift in the vocabulary used for describing the objects under discussion, which have not occurred to any of the audiences to whom the belief in question has so far been justified. This sort of gesture toward an unpredictable future is made, for example, when we say that our present moral and scientific beliefs may look as primitive to our remote descendants as those of the Greeks look to us. My grounding premise that you can only work for what you could recognize is a corollary of James's principle that a difference has to make a difference to practice before it's worth discussing. The only difference between truth and justification which makes such a difference is, as far as I can see, the difference between old audiences and new audiences. So I take the appropriate pragmatist attitude toward truth to be, it's no more necessary to have a philosophical theory about the nature of truth or the meaning of the word true than it is to have one about the nature of danger or the meaning of the word danger. The principal reason we have a word like danger in the language is to caution people, to warn them that they may not have envisaged all the consequences of their proposed action. We pragmatists, who think that beliefs are habits of action rather than attempts to correspond to reality, see the cautionary use of the word true as flagging a special sort of danger. We use it to remind ourselves that people in different circumstances, people facing future audiences, may not be able to justify the belief which we have triumphantly justified to all the audiences we have encountered. Given this pragmatist view of the function of the word true, what about the claim that all human beings desire truth? This claim is ambiguous between the claim that all of them desire to justify their beliefs to some, though not necessarily all, other human beings, and the claim that they all want their beliefs to be true. The first claim seems to me unobjectionable. The second claim, however, seems dubious unless it's merely an alternative formulation of the first. For the only other interpretation which we pragmatists can give to the second claim is that all human beings are concerned about the danger that someday an audience will come into being before whom a presently justified belief cannot be justified. But in the first place, mere fallibilism is not what philosophers who hope to make the notion of truth relevant to democratic politics want. In the second place, such fallibilism is not, in fact, a feature of all human beings. It is much more prevalent among inhabitants of wealthy, secure, tolerant, inclusivist societies than elsewhere, for these people are brought up to bethink themselves that they might be mistaken, that there are people out there who might disagree with them and whose disagreement needs to be taken into account. If you favor democratic politics, you will want to encourage fallibilism. But there are other ways to do so beside harping on the difference between the conditional character of justification and the unconditional character of truth. One might, for example, harp on the sad fact that many previous communities have betrayed their own interests by being too sure of themselves and so failing to attend to objections raised by outsiders. Furthermore, we should distinguish between fallibilism and philosophical skepticism. Fallibilism has nothing in particular to do with the quest for universality and unconditionality. Skepticism does. One will usually not go into philosophy, at least in Anglophone countries, unless one is impressed by the sort of skepticism found in Descartes' Meditations, the sort of skepticism which says that the mere possibility of error defeats knowledge claims. Not many people find this sort of skepticism interesting. But those who do ask themselves, is there any way in which we can insure ourselves against having beliefs which may be unjustifiable to some future audience? Is there any way in which we can ensure that we have beliefs justifiable to any and every audience? The tiny minority which finds this question interesting consists almost entirely of philosophy professors and divides into three groups. First, skeptics like Stroud, who say that Descartes' argument from dreams is unanswerable. For the skeptics, there's always an audience, the future self who is awoken from the dream, which will not be satisfied by any justification offered by our present, possibly dreaming self. Second, foundationalists like Chisholm, who say that even if we're now dreaming, we can't be wrong about certain beliefs, certain of our beliefs. Third, coherentists like Sellars say that, I quote Sellars, all our beliefs are up for grabs, though not all at once. We pragmatists, who have been impressed by Peirce's criticisms of Descartes, think that both skeptics and foundationalists are led astray by the picture of beliefs as attempts to represent reality, and by the associated idea that truth is a matter of correspondence to reality. So we become coherentists. But we coherentists remain divided about what, if anything, needs to be said about truth. I think that once one has explicated the difference between justification and truth by that between present and future justifiability, there is little more to be said. Some of my fellow coherentists, Oppel, Habermas, and Putnam, think, as Peirce also did, that there's a lot more to be said and that saying it is important for democratic politics. Section 4, Universal Validity and Context Transcendence. Putnam, Oppel, and Habermas all take over from Peirce an idea which I reject, the idea of convergence upon the one truth. Instead of arguing that because reality is one and truth corresponds to that one reality, Peirceans argue that the idea of convergence is built into the presuppositions of discourse. They all agree that the principal reason why reason cannot be naturalized is that reason is normative and norms cannot be naturalized. But, they say, we can make room for the normative without going back to the traditional idea of a duty to correspond to the intrinsic nature of reality. We do this by attending to the universalistic character of the idealizing presuppositions of discourse. This strategy has the advantage of setting aside meta-ethical questions about whether there is a moral reality to which our moral judgments might hope to correspond, as our physical science supposedly hopes to correspond to physical reality. Habermas says that every validity claim, quote, has a transcendent moment of universal validity which bursts every provinciality asunder. In addition to the validity claim's strategic role in some context-bound discussion. As I see it, the only truth in this idea is that many claims to validity are made by people who would be willing to defend their claims before audiences other than the one which they're currently addressing. Not all assertions, obviously, are of this sort. Lawyers, for example, are quite aware that they fashion their claims to suit the quaint context of a highly local jurisprudence. But willingness to take on new and unfamiliar audiences is one thing, bursting provinciality asunder is another. Habermas's doctrine of a transcendent moment seems to me to run together a commendable willingness to try something new with an empty boast. To say, I'll try to defend this belief against all comers, is often, depending upon the circumstances, a commendable attitude. But to say, I can successfully defend this against all comers is silly. Maybe you can, but you're in no more a position to say that than the village champion is to claim that he can beat the world champion. The only sort of situation in which you would be in a position to say the latter is one in which the rules of the argumentative game have been agreed upon in advance, as in normal as opposed to revolutionary mathematics, for example. But in most cases, including the moral and political claims in which Habermas is most interested, there are no such rules. The notion of context dependence has a clear sense in the sorts of cases I've just mentioned, in provincial law courts and in language games such as normal mathematics, regulated by clear and explicit conventions. For most assertions, however, Either the notion of context dependence nor the notion of universal validity has such a sense. For most assertions, such as Clinton is the better candidate, Alexander came before Caesar, gold is insoluble in hydrochloric acid, and the like, it's hard to see why I should ask myself, is my claim context dependent or universal? No difference to practice is going to be made by coming down in favor of one alternative rather than the other. Habermas puts forward an analog of this distinction between the context-dependent and the universal, which might seem more relevant to practice. This analog is what he calls the tension between facticity and validity. He views this tension as a central philosophical problem and says that this tension is responsible for many of the difficulties encountered in theorizing democratic politics. He thinks it is a distinctive and valuable feature of his theory of communicative action that, quote, it already absorbs the tension between facticity and validity into its fundamental concept. It does so by distinguishing between the strategic use of discourse and what he calls the use of language oriented to reaching understanding. This latter distinction might seem just the one we're looking for, the one which lets us interpret the distinction between context dependence in universality and universality in a way which makes a difference to practice. As I see it, however, the distinction between the strategic and non-strategic use of language is just the distinction between cases in which all we care about is convincing others and cases in which we hope to learn something. In the latter set of cases, we are quite willing to give up our present views if we hear something better. These cases are two ends of a spectrum, at one end of which we shall use any dirty trick we can, lying, omitting the truth, suggesting the false, and so on, to convince. At the other end, we talk to others as we talk to ourselves, when we are most at ease, most reflective, and most curious. Most of the time, we're somewhere in the middle between these two extremes. My problem is, I don't see that these two extremes have anything in particular to do with a distinction between context dependence and universality. The pure pursuit of truth is the traditional name for the sort of conversation which takes place at one end of this spectrum. But I don't see what that sort of conversation has to do with universality or with unconditionality. It is non-strategic in the sense that in such conversations we let the wind blow where it listeth, but it's hard to see that the assertions we make in such conversations presuppose something which is not presupposed in the assertions I make when I'm at the other end of the spectrum, the dirty tricks end of the spectrum. Habermas, however, thinks that unless we recognize, quote, that the validity claims raised hic et nunc and aimed at intersubjective recognition or acceptance can at the same time overshoot local standards for taking yes-no positions, we shall not see that this transcendent moment alone distinguishes the practices of justification oriented to truth claims from other practices that are regulated merely by social convention. This passage is a good example of what seems to me Habermas's undesirable commitment to the logocentric distinction between opinion and knowledge, a distinction between mere obedience to nomoi, to the norms of social practices, even the sort of nomoi which would be found in a utopian democratic society, and the kind of fousse by nature relation to reality which is provided by the grasp of truth. Both the opinion knowledge and the nomos phusis distinction appear to Deweyans as remnants of Plato's obsession with the kind of certainty found in mathematics, and more generally with the idea that the universal, being somehow eternal and unconditional, provides an escape from what is particular, temporal, and conditioned. In this passage, Habermas is, I take it, using the term practices of justification oriented to truth claims to refer to the nice end of the spectrum I described above. But from my point of view, truth has nothing to do with it. Transcend social convention, rather they're regulated by certain particular social conventions, those of a society even more democratic, tolerant, leisured, wealthy, and diverse than our own, one in which inclusivism is built into everyone's sense of moral identity. In this society, everybody always welcomes strange opinions on all sorts of topics. These are also the conventions of certain lucky parts of contemporary society. For example, universities, seminars, summer camps for intellectuals, and the like. Perhaps the most far-reaching difference between Habermas and I is that pragmatists like myself sympathize with the anti-metaphysical, so-called postmodern thinkers whom Habermas criticizes, when they suggest that the idea of a distinction between social practice and what transcends such practice is an undesirable remnant of logocentrism. Foucault and Dewey can agree that whether or not inquiry is always a matter of power, it never transcends social practice. So incidentally can Brandom. So this you know, this issue comes up in the context of Brandom's work tomorrow. Both would say that the only thing that can transcend a social practice is another social practice, just as the only thing that can transcend a present audience is a future audience. Similarly, the only thing that can transcend a discursive strategy is another discursive strategy, one aimed at other, better goals. But because I don't know how to aim at it, I don't think that truth names such a goal. I know how to aim at greater honesty, greater charity, greater patience, greater inclusiveness, and so on. I see democratic politics as serving such concrete, desirable goals. But I don't see that it helps things to add truth or universality or unconditionality to the list of goals, for I don't see what we will do differently depending on whether or not we make such additions. It may sound at this point as if the difference between me and Habermas is one that makes no difference to practice. We both have the same utopias in mind, we both engage in the same sort of democratic politics, so why quibble about the difference between whether to call utopian communication practices oriented to truth or not? Why quibble about the whole subject of the relevance of truth to democratic politics? The answer is that Habermas thinks it does make a difference to practice because he gets to make an argumentative move which isn't open to me. He gets to accuse his opponents of performative self-contradiction. Habermas thinks that, quote, "The universal discourse of an unbounded community of interpretation is unavoidably assumed by anybody, even me, who gets into any argument." He says, quote, "Even if these presuppositions have an ideal content that can only be approximately satisfied, all participants must de facto accept them, accept the presuppositions of communication, whether they assert or deny the truth of a statement in any way and would like to enter into argumentation aimed at justifying this validity claim." My experience of speaking in Frankfurt is invariably that at a certain point Oppel will accuse me of performative self-contradiction. And you know, this is the standard Frankfurt move, as, you know, sort of the basic strategy of the school. But what about somebody who is outraged, as are many trustees of American universities, by the social conventions of the better parts of the better universities, places where even the most paradoxical and unpromising claims are seriously discussed, and in which feminists, atheists, homosexuals, blacks, etc., are taken seriously as moral equals and conversational partners? I take it that on Habermas's view, such a person will be contradicting himself if he offers arguments to the effect that these conventions should be replaced by other, more exclusivist conventions. By contrast, I can't tell the narrow-minded university trustee that he's contradicting himself. I can only try to wheedle him into greater tolerance by the usual indirect means, giving examples of present platitudes which were once paradoxes, of the contributions to culture made by black female homosexual atheists, and so on. The big question of whether anybody has ever been convinced by the charge, the big question is whether anybody has ever been convinced by the charge of performative self-contradiction. I don't think that there are many clear examples of such a change being taken to heart. If you tell a bigot of the sort I've sketched that he's committed to making context-surpassing validity claims, to aiming at truth, he'll probably agree that that's exactly what he's doing. If you tell him that he can't make such claims and still balk at the paradoxes or the people at whom he balks, he will probably not get the point. He will say that people who advance such paradoxes are too crazy to argue with or argue about, that women have a distorted view of reality and the like. He will think it irrational or immoral or both to take such paradoxes and people seriously. That's why he doesn't think the university should allow them to teach, speak, and so on. I can't see much difference between the bigot's reaction to me and Habermas and Habermas's and my reactions to him. I can't see that anything like communicative reason favors our reactions rather than his. This is because I don't see why the term reason is not as much up for grabs as the term academic freedom or morality or pervert. nor how the anti-foundationalist coherentism, which Habermas and I share, can make room for a non-recontextualizable, non-relativizable conversation stopper called performative self-contradiction. What the bigot and I do, and I think should do, when told that we have violated a presupposition of communication, is to haggle about the meanings of the terms used in stating the purported presupposition. Terms like true, argument, reason, communication, domination, and so on. This haggling will, with luck, eventually turn into a mutually profitable conversation about our respective utopias, our respective ideas about what an ideal society or university empowering an ideally competent audience would look like. But this conversation is not likely to end with the bigot's reluctant admission that he has entangled himself in a contradiction, even if I should, by a miracle, succeed in convincing him of the worth of my utopia. His reaction will be to regret his own previous lack of curiosity and imagination rather than to regret his failure to spot his own presuppositions. Next section is about Albrecht, an argument of Albrecht Wellmer's, who's sort of associated with Habermas but differs from him in various interesting ways. I agree with Oppo and Habermas that Peirce was right in telling us to talk about discourse rather than about consciousness, but I think that the only ideal presupposed by discourse is that of being able to justify your beliefs to a competent audience. As a coherentist, I think that if you can agree with other members of such an audience about what is to be done, then you don't have to worry about your relation to reality. But everything depends upon what constitutes a competent audience. Unlike Hoppe and Habermas, the moral I draw from Peirce is that we philosophers who are concerned with democratic politics should leave truth alone as a sublimely undiscussable topic, and instead turn to the question of how to persuade people to broaden the size of the audience they take to be competent to increase the size of the relevant community of justification. The latter project is not only relevant to democratic politics, it pretty much is democratic politics. Hoppe and Habermas think that the demand to maximize the size of this community is already, so to speak, built into communicative action. This is the cash value of their claim that every assertion claims universal validity. Albrecht Wellmer, like me, rejects the convergentism which Habermas and Oppel share with Putnam. But he nevertheless accepts their claim that our truth claims, quote, transcend the context, the local or cultural context in which they are raised. My problem with Wellmer, Oppel, and Habermas is that I don't see what the pragmatic force of saying that an argument which, like all other arguments, convinces certain people and not others is a good argument. This seems like saying that a tool which, like all tools, is useful for certain purposes but not others is a good tool. Imagine the surgeon who, after unsuccessfully attempting to dig a tunnel out of his prison cell with his scalpel, saying, still, it's a good tool. Then picture him saying, after unsuccessfully trying to convince his guards to let him escape so that he may resume his position as leader of the resistance, saying, still, they were good arguments. My problem is intensified when I ask myself whether my truth claims transcend my local cultural context. I have no clear idea whether they do or not, because I can't see what transcendence means here. I can't even see what the point of taking my assertion as making a truth claim is. When I believe that P and express this belief by asserting it in the course of a conversation, am I making a claim? What's the force of saying that? What does saying that add to saying that I am, to speak with Peirce, informing my interlocutor about my habits of action, giving her hints about how to predict and control my future conversational and non-conversational behavior? Depending on the situation at hand, I may also be inviting her to disagree with me by telling me about her different habits of action, suggesting that I'm prepared to give reasons for my belief, trying to make a good impression on her, and a thousand other things. As Austin reminded us, there are lots of things I do when I make an assertion which can be interpreted as part of the give and take between me and my interlocutor. This give and take is a matter of roughly the reciprocal adjustment of our behavior the strategic coordination of that behavior in ways which may prove mutually profitable. Of course, if somebody asks me after I have asserted P whether I believe that P is true, I shall say yes. But I shall wonder, as Wittgenstein did, what the point of that question was. Is he questioning my sincerity? Is he expressing incredulity about my ability to offer reasons for my belief? I can try to straighten things out by asking the questioner to spell out why he asked. But he replies, I just wanted to be sure you are making a context-transcendent truth claim. I'll be baffled. What does he want to be reassured about, exactly? What would it be like for me to make a context-dependent assertion? Of course, in the trivial sense that an assertion may not always be apropos, all assertions are context-dependent. But what would it mean for the proposition asserted to be context-dependent as opposed to the speech act being context-dependent? I'm not sure how people like Habermas and Velmer, who've given up on correspondence theories of truth and consequently can't distinguish between a claim to report a habit of action and a claim to represent reality, can draw this distinction between context dependence and context independence. My best guess is that they believe that, in Velmer's words, quote, whenever we raise a truth claim on the basis of what we take to be good arguments or compelling evidence, we take the epistemic conditions prevailing here and now to be ideal in the following sense. We presuppose that no arguments or evidence will come up in the future which would put our own truth claims into question. Or, as Velmer also puts it, quote, relying upon reasons or evidences as compelling means to exclude the possibility of being proved wrong as time goes on, close quote. If that's what it takes to make a context-transcendent truth claim, then I have never made one. I would not know how to exclude the possibility that Velmer described. Nor would I know how to presuppose that no arguments or evidence will turn up in the future which will cast doubt on my belief. Relying once again on the fundamental pragmatist principle that any difference has to make a difference to practice, I want to know whether this excluding or presupposing are things I can decide to do or not do. If they are, I want to know more about how to go about doing them. If they aren't, they seem to me empty. I can make my point in another way by asking, what's the difference between a metaphysician committed to a correspondence theory of truth telling me that whether I know it or will admit it or not, my assertions automatically, willy-nilly, amount to a claim to represent reality accurately, and my fellow Persians telling me that they automatically, willy-nilly, amount to an exclusion of possibilities or a presupposition about what the future holds. In both cases, I'm being told that I presuppose something which, even after considerable reflection, I don't think I believe. But the notion of presupposition, when it's extended to beliefs which the purported presupposer stoutly denies, becomes hard to distinguish from the notion of redescription of person A in person B's language. If A can explain what I'm doing and why I'm doing it in her own terms, what right has B got to keep on saying, no, what you, A, are really doing is so-and-so? In the case at hand, we Deweyans think we have a perfectly good way of describing our own behavior, behavior of which Habermas approves, in ways which eschew terms like universal, unconditional, and transcendence. It seems to me, in the spirit of Peirce's criticism of Descartes' make-believe doubt, to raise the question of whether we are not dealing here with make-believe transcendence, a sort of make-believe response to a make-believe doubt. Real doubt, Peirce said, comes when some concrete difficulty is envisaged if one acts according to the habit which is the belief. Such a difficulty might be, for example, having to seize asserting and believing some relevant but conflicting proposition. Real transcendence, I should say, occurs when I say, I am prepared to justify this belief not just to people who share the following premises with me, but to lots of other people who don't share those premises but with whom I share certain others. The question whether I am so prepared is a concrete, practical question, whose answer I determine by, for example, imaginatively previewing various other audiences' responses to my assertion and my subsequent behavior. But such experiments in imagination obviously have limits. I can't imagine myself defending my assertion to any possible audience. In the first place, I can usually dream up audiences to whom it would be pointless to try to justify my beliefs. Try defending about beliefs about justice to Neanderthals or Nazi prison guards, or about quarks to Aristotle, or about trigonometry to three-year-olds. In the second place, no good pragmatist ever uses the term all possible. He doesn't know how to imagine or discover the bounds of possibility. Indeed, he can't figure out what the point of attempting such a feat would be. Under what concrete circumstances would it be important to consider the difference between all the X's I can think of and all possible X's? How could that difference make a difference to practice? I conclude that Velmer's way of distinguishing between context-dependent and context-independent claims can't be made plausible, at least to pragmatists. Since I can think of no better way, I think we should ask why Velmer, Oppel, and Habermas think this distinction worth drawing. The obvious answer is that they want to avoid what they call the relativism, which contextualism purportedly entails. So I turn now to what Velmer calls the antinomy of truth, the clash between relativist and absolutist intuitions. Toward the beginning of his essay, Truth, Contingency, and Modernity, Velmer writes as follows. If there is irresolvable disagreement about the possibility of justifying truth claims, about standards of argumentation or evidential support, e.g. between members of different linguistic, scientific, or cultural communities, may I still suppose that there are, somewhere, the correct standards, the right criteria, in short, that there is an objective truth of the matter? Or should I rather think that truth is relative to cultures, languages, communities, or even persons? While relativism, the second alternative, appears to be inconsistent, absolutism, the first alternative, seems to imply metaphysical assumptions. Let's call this the antinomy of truth. Much important philosophical work has been done in the last decades to resolve this antinomy, either by trying to show that absolutism need not be metaphysical, or by trying to show that the critique of absolutism need not lead to relativism. End of quote. My problem with Velmer's antinomy is that I don't think that denying that there are the correct standards should lead anybody to say that truth, as opposed to justification, is relative to something. As far as I can see, nobody would think that the critique of absolutism leads to relativism unless she thought that the only reason for justifying our beliefs to each other is that such justification makes it more likely that our beliefs are true. I don't think there's any reason to think that such justification makes it more likely that our beliefs are true. But I don't think that's a cause for concern, since I don't think that our practice of justifying our beliefs needs justification. If I'm right that the only indispensable function of the word true, or any other indefinable normative term such as good or right, is to caution, to warn against danger by making gestures toward unpredictable situations, future audiences, future moral dilemmas, etc., then it doesn't make much sense to ask whether or not justification leads to truth. Justification to more and more audiences leads to less and less danger of rebuttal, and thus to less and less need for caution. If I convince them, we often say to ourselves, I should be able to convince anybody. But one would only say that it leads to truth if one could somehow project from the conditioned to the unconditioned, from all imaginable to all possible audiences. Such a projection makes some sense if one believes in convergence. For such a belief sees the space of reasons as finite and structured, so that as more and more audiences are satisfied, more and more members of a finite set of possible objections are eliminated. One will be encouraged to see the space of reasons in this way if one is a representationalist, because one will see reality, or at least the spatio-temporal hunk of reality relevant to human concerns, as finite and as constantly shoving us out of error and toward truth, discouraging inaccurate representations of itself, and thereby producing increasingly accurate ones. But if one does not take knowledge to be accurate representation of reality, nor truth to be correspondence to reality, then it's harder to be a convergentist and harder to think of the space of reasons as finite and structured. Filmer, it seems to me, wants to project from the conditioned our various experiences of success in justifying our beliefs to the unconditioned truth. The big difference between me and Velmer is that I think the answer to Velmer's question, this is a quote from Velmer, do our democratic and liberal principles define just one possible political language game among others, is an unqualified yes. Velmer, however, thinks, quote, a qualified no can be justified, and by justification I now mean not justification for us, but justification period. End of quote. As I see it, the very idea of justification period commits Velmer to the thesis that the logical space of reason giving is finite and structured. So I would urge him to abandon the latter thesis for the same reasons that he abandoned Oppel's and Habermas's convergentism. But oddly enough, these reasons are pretty much the reasons he gives for giving his qualified no. Velmer's central point in defense of this qualified no answer is one which I wholeheartedly accept. Namely, that the very idea of incompatible and perhaps reciprocally unintelligible language games is a pointless fiction, and that in real cases, representatives of different traditions and cultures can always find a way to talk over their differences. I entirely agree with Velmer when he says, quote, rationality, in any relevant sense of the word, cannot end at the borderline of closed language games, since there is no such thing as a closed language game, close quote. My disagreement with Velmer starts when, after a semicolon, Velmer finishes that sentence with, but then the ethnocentric contextuality of all argumentation is quite well compatible with the raising of truth claims which transcend the context, the local or cultural context, in which they are raised and in which they can be justified. I should have finished that same sentence by saying, but then the ethnocentric contextuality of all argumentation is quite well compatible with the claim that a liberal and democratic society can bring together, include all sorts of diverse ethnoi, all sorts of diverse local, cultural, social practices. Here's a way of summing up the difference between me and Velmer. We agree that one reason to prefer democracies is that they enable us to construct ever bigger and better contexts of discussion. But I stop there, and Velmer goes on. He adds that this reason is not just a justification of democracy for us, but a justification, period. He thinks that the democratic and liberal principles of modernity should, pace rorti, be understood in a universalistic sense. My problem, of course, is that I don't have the option of understanding them that way. Pragmatists like me can't figure out how to tell whether we're understanding a justification as just a justification for us or as a justification, period. This strikes me as like trying to tell whether I think of my scalpel or my computer as a good tool for the task at hand or a good tool, period. At this point, however, one can imagine Velmer rejoining, then so much the worse for pragmatism. Any view which makes you unable to understand a distinction everybody else understands must have something wrong with it. My rebuttal would be, you're only entitled to that distinction as long as you can back it up with a distinction between what seem good reasons to us and what seem good reasons to something like an ahistorical Kantian tribunal of reason. But you deprived yourself of that possibility when you gave up on convergentism and thus gave up the non-metaphysical Frankfurt substitute for such a tribunal, viz. The idealization called the undistorted communication situation. I agree with Velmer that, quote, democratic and liberal institutions are the only ones which could possibly coexist with a recognition of contingency and still reproduce their own legitimacy, close quote. At least if one takes the term reproduce their own legitimacy to mean something like make its view of the situation of human beings in the universe hang together with its political practices. But I don't think that the recognition of contingency serves as a justification period for democratic politics, because I don't think it does what Velmer says, namely, quote, destroys the intellectual bases of dogmatism, foundationalism, authoritarianism, and of moral and legal inequality. This is because I don't think that dogmatism or moral inequality have intellectual bases. If I am a bigoted proponent of the inequality of blacks, women, and homosexuals to straight white males, I need not necessarily appeal to the denial of contingency by invoking a metaphysical theory about the true nature of human beings. I could do that, but I might also, when it came to philosophy, be a pragmatist. A bigot and I can say the same Foucauldian Nietzschean thing, that the only real question is one of power, the question of which community is going to inherit the earth, mine or my opponent's. One's choice of a community for that role is intertwined with one's sense of what counts as a competent audience. You know, do only Aryans count as a competent audience? You know, do only Christians count as a competent audience? Do only liberal Democrats count as a competent, so forth. The fact that there are no mutually unintelligible language games, the point Velmer insists on and which Davidson, I think, effectively argues for, the fact that there are no mutually unintelligible language games does not in itself do much to show that disputes between racists and anti-racists, Democrats and fascists, can be decided without resort to force. Both sides may agree that although they understand what each other says perfectly well and share common views on most topics, including perhaps the recognition of contingency, the falsehood of phallogocentrism, and so on, there seems no prospect of reaching agreement on the particular issue at hand. So both sides say, as they reach for their guns, it looks as if we'll have to fight it out. My answer to Velmer's question about whether our democratic and liberal principles define just one possible political language game among others is yes, if the force of the question is to ask whether there is something in the nature of discourse which singles our game out. I can't see what other force the question could have, and I think we have to rest content with saying that no philosophical thesis, either about contingency or about truth, does anything decisive for democratic politics. By decisive, I mean doing what Oppel and Habermas want to do, convicting the anti-democrat of a performative self-contradiction. The most that an insistence on contingency can do for democracy is to supply one more debating point on the democratic side of the argument, just as the insistence that, for example, only the Aryan race is in tune with the intrinsic necessary nature of things can supply one more debating point on the other side. I can't take the latter point seriously, but I don't think that there's anything self-contradictory in the Nazis' refusal to take me seriously, so we may both have to reach for our guns. I'll stop there and continue on this afternoon.